All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kochel for Stand to Reason. And it's so nice of you to join me today, to talk with me, listen to me, share with me with my callers on the critical issues of life, ethics, values, religion, the most important things we could ever talk about, friends. We are going to bring some clear thinking to those issues today, as we do every Sunday, 3 until 5. And if you'd like to get in the queue and chat with me about anything that's on your mind in those areas, you're welcome to do so. People are already lining up. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. And if you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150 is the local number to me here at the studio in Costa Mesa. And this week I want to kick off with some comments about what the recent mailing from Stand to Reason covers, and that is embryonic stem cell research. And I'm going to take it from a little different angle than I usually have taken it, partly because I think there is so much incredible confusion on this issue, and people are confused who ought to know better. That is, people who are politicians, people who are media people, people who are reporters. These are people who are supposed to do their homework and understand some foundational things. They haven't done that. They're spouting out things that simply are not true, are deeply misleading, and then they confuse the whole issue. And therefore, those who are this confused, they look at people like you and I who are standing against embryonic stem cell research, and they basically characterize us as people who just really want to see other people suffer in their diseases simply because of some ideological quirk that we have, some step of faith that we've taken, that that we are clinging to, a dogma that we hold without reason, that is consigning millions upon millions in a lifetime of suffering. Well, this obviously isn't the case. And what amazes me is how many Christians, frankly, and even pro-lifers are confused on this issue, and how much disinformation is going out there. So I'm just going to kick off by dealing with a couple of, shall we say, misconceptions about stem cell research, and more specifically, embryonic stem cell research. And you need to have, maybe you could just jot a couple of things down so you can review these four or five points that I have, these points of disinformation and miscommunication. And then I'm going to focus in on what the actual concern is about embryonic stem cell research without going into much detail, because many of you have heard this already. I make some of these points in the new Solid Ground that's just come out. It's probably been mailed to your home already if you're receiving Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. And that deals with the confusing moral logic of embryonic stem cell research. And there I reflect on why it is that those who are pro-abortion feel a need to defend embryonic stem cell research in light of their views. And those who are pro-life also are defending, many are defending embryonic stem cell research as well, in my view, betraying their pro-life view, which shows that many, even people who should know better, don't understand what I've come to call the moral logic of the pro-life view. Now, let me just hit on a couple of these things that are there's deep confusion about. I have heard more than once at the Democratic National Convention, for example, from the lips of John Kerry, in other occasions, that Mr. Bush has followed a shameful practice of banning embryonic stem cell research, and that a new administration would lift the ban on embryonic stem cell research. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no such ban. There is no ban on embryonic stem cell research. In fact, this president has given money, millions upon millions of dollars, specifically for embryonic stem cell research. All right? In fact, there's an initiative that is going to be on the ballot in this state of California come 58 days or so, entitled the California Stem Cell Research and Cures Initiative, which asks you to allow the government to borrow through a bond $3 billion to apply towards embryonic stem cell research. Now, how can you have a referendum initiative here in the state of California for embryonic stem cell research if embryonic stem cell research is banned. It is not. There's no ban on embryonic stem cell research. What the government, what the president has done with the support of Congress, and I think it was 1996, the pass, or the, actually it was it 1996? Not president, obviously this president, but since then. Well, let's forget about the dates. Melinda says, whenever you use dates, you sound senile. So forget about dates. But what the present President Bush has done is he has limited the current scientific study on embryonic stem cells to existing embryonic stem cells that we have in our possession. There is a ban only on federal funds to create new lines of embryonic stem cells. And there's a reason for the ban on that very narrow thing. As I've said in the past, there's only one place that you can get embryonic stem cells from, and that is human embryos. Now, the stem cell lines that we have of embryonic stem cells are existing because of the deaths of past embryos. That's done and gone with. The stem cell lines that we have that are that we are doing research on do not entail taking the lives of any new embryos. Okay? So there's no problem with that. What the president has banned is creating new embryos or destroying existing embryos with federal funds to create new lines. Private agencies can create new lines without any difficulty. There's no limitations there. And so this idea that the president and the present administration, with the blessing of the religious right, has banned embryonic stem cell research is simply false. There is no ban on it, ladies and gentlemen. There is only a restriction of further funds to destroy new embryos, whether created through cloning or already created through in vitro fertilization and sitting in the freezer somewhere, and using those to create new lines of stem cells. Okay? There is no ban on any embryonic stem cell research, and two, there is no ban on funds for embryonic stem cell research. Funds are available as long as the research is being done on existing lines. Third point of confusion. Many people have argued against the ridiculous position that the religious right, the conservatives, the wackos who are against embryonic stem cell research treat a cell the size of a head of a pin as a full human being. The answer to that is, in what they're speaking of, no. That is, nobody who is informed properly on the issue believes that an embryonic stem cell is actually a full human being. It is not. It's an embryonic stem cell. But as I mentioned a few moments ago, where do you get a human embryonic stem cell from? You have to get it from a human embryo. And so the moral problem isn't that the stem cell is a human being and therefore reproducing and doing reproducing those cells in a stem cell line and doing research on those stem cells is doing research on human beings. The problem is where you get the stem cells from. And any new human embryonic stem cells must come from some new human embryo that must be destroyed, and in that is the moral concern. And so, for me as a person concerned about embryonic stem cells and embryonic stem cell research, I'm only against one thing, killing other human beings to get the body parts that will be used in research in the future. I'm not saying the body part is the human being. The cell isn't the human being. The cell is a part of a human being that was destroyed to get those cells. That's the moral problem. Embryos are killed for their cells. And you know what's ironic about this is I read an article just a couple days ago, got from the internet, about somebody who had been involved with the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation. I don't have it in front of me. I left it at home on my hurry to get out to the studio on time today. But it was somebody involved with that, and they went to speak to their own congressperson to persuade them, in light of the information they had been given by the foundation, for that congressman to support embryonic stem cell research. And the congressman gave him a little bit of information, like I'm giving you today. And instead of persuading the congressman to be in favor of embryonic stem cell research, the congressman persuaded the people to be against it, because they had not been informed that new embryonic stem cell lines must come from a human embryo that is sacrificed in the process. These people who are campaigning with the congressman were pro-life people trying to get him to go along with them on embryonic stem cell research, not realizing that the process destroyed a human being, which would be contrary to their pro-life principles. See, they were operating in the dark on this. They didn't understand. What we're against, that is, pro-lifers, those who have principled objections against this, it isn't because of some article of faith that we get out of our Bibles, per se. It isn't because of some fast-talking priest from the pulpit that has twisted our thinking. It is because we have thought carefully about the issue, and we have come to the conclusion that this kind of science, when it destroys a living human being, because it does so, is illicit. And therefore, we stand against the destruction of living human beings to promote science, not the use of science to do any research on stem cells per se. And this brings me to my final point. The first one is there's no ban on embryonic stem cell research. There is no ban. In fact, federal funds are available for embryonic stem cell research as long as we're working with the existing lines. Second, there is a ban on funds for new embryonic stem cell lines because they kill innocent human beings to get them. Third, none of us who knows the details believes that the cells themselves are human beings. It's just that they must come from a bona fide human being who sacrifices his or her life for science without their consent, obviously. And this fourth is the moral problem. The embryo is killed for its cells. The final point that I want to make is something that it stuns me that there are so many people who have just simply ignored this. Larry King had a special on embryonic stem cell research, within the last week or so. And Johnny Erickson Tata was there arguing against the use of embryonic stem cells for the reasons I've just described, those that come from new embryos. And that's what the push is. Make new embryos. Either kill the ones that are in vitro frozen, that were embryonic embryos from in vitro fertilization and are now frozen, kill those to get embryonic stem cells, or create new ones through a somatic cell nuclear transfer, SCNT, in other words, cloning, which is what Ron Reagan promoted without using the C word during the DNC. He described human cloning as a way of getting new human embryos, which then are divided up for their cells and for research. What Larry King was not interested in hearing about from Johnny Erickson Tata was the fact that it is not embryonic stem cells that hold the greatest promise, but rather it is adult stem cells that show the greatest promise. In fact, they don't just show the greatest promise, they are delivering on that promise. And there is a list of significant advances in medical cures in virtually every single area that's being studied, especially in Parkinson's disease, that has been accomplished by using adult stem cells that come from the adults themselves that need the therapy. And so if you're using that adult stem cells, guess what? You don't have a problem with rejection. And of course, there's no moral problems because the adults are giving their own cells with their consent. And so you have a very promising option here with adult stem cell research with no problems of rejection by the host, no tumors developing like we see happening with those developed out of embryonic stem cell research, no problems with human cloning, no sacrificed human embryos, and proven results. Larry King did not want to hear about it. What he wanted to hear about was embryonic stem cell research. He just dismissed her. And this is so troublesome to me, ladies and gentlemen. I don't understand what's going on in the minds of people. It's like they are so fixated on this thing. They want embryonic stem cell research, and it's almost as if because the people on the right, particularly the religious right, are against it, they are going to campaign for it regardless of whether it's any good, regardless of whether it makes a difference medically, regardless if there are other alternatives that don't have these problems associated with them that are showing much more promise. And I'll give you one guaranteed indication that is showing much more promise. Private sector money is flowing into the research with adult stem cells. Now, why would the private sector be investing money in adult stem cell research? Because it shows promise. Why don't they pay for and invest in embryonic stem cell research? It's not illegal. There are no bans on it. The reason that private sector funds are not going into it is because they don't have confidence, based on the evidence so far, it's going to produce a result that will be profitable. This is precisely why you have on the ballot this fall the California Stem Cell Research and Cures Initiative, where they're asking for $3 billion of your money to pay for something using public money that the private sector does not want to invest in. That ought to tell you something. The private sector doesn't want to put its money into it. It's not a good gamble. You follow the money. Where's the private sector putting their money in? Adult stem cell research, because that is paying off. So, friends, there's no ban on embryonic stem cell research. There's no ban on funds for embryonic stem cell research. There's only a ban on making new lines because that requires killing human embryos. Nobody believes that embryonic stem cells are human beings, but they come from human beings who are sacrificed for the process. And that's the thing that I'm against and pro-lifers are against, taking the lives of innocent human beings for research. Now, if you can get around that, no problem. And in fact, there is a way to get around that. Adult stem cells, which have produced tremendous results in the last few years and have great promise without the downside. No rejection, no tumors, no cloning, no sacrificed human embryos, proven results. Those are the facts that I wish people could get straight. It isn't hard to find out about that. I don't understand why presidential candidates can't get their facts straight. I don't understand why people who are supposed to be good at research, like reporters and Larry King, can't get their facts straight. And it makes me wonder, what is going through their mind? I don't know. And sometimes you wonder if it's just a knee-jerk reaction against people they don't like you and I. The right, the religious right. And so whatever they believe, the left is going to be against. I mean, I could be totally wrong in that, but that's the only thing I've got to go on right now, because there's sure no sensibility connected with their promotion of embryonic stem cell research. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. We'll be back in just a few moments with your phone calls right here on STR.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today here on Stand to Reason with Christianity Worth Thinking About. I don't really want to ignore the fact that yesterday was our memorial of 9-1-1, 3 years, of course, and I'm sure that many of you, as I did, watched something special on TV as a summary. I did it about 11 o'clock at night last night. I had a full day for other reasons, but it was very, very touching watching the documentary and just being reminded of the wound that we suffered, not only in the landscape of Manhattan, but in our collective consciousness here in America, and the reasons why we suffered that wound. And I hope that 3 years now has not caused us to forget the threat that remains. And I am concerned that that's happened to some degree. But the threat is real, and it is not just a threat against this country. Countries all over the world have felt the impact of fundamentalist Islam, and that's the issue. Not terrorism writ large, but a religious point of view that will have no other way but its own, and that's the problem. Anyway, time to get to the calls, and let's go to Rick. Rick, you're up first. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Hi, Greg.
Hi there.
How you doing?
Okay. You called last week, did you?
I did, but we didn't get to talk because we ran out of time.
Yeah, you got the short trip there. I'm glad you called at the beginning of the show. That's one of the
keys.
Yeah,
that's what I'm – it's like I want to get this stuff done, so I have something to say.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was talking to him. We were just arguing about – she was saying, you know, you can't use history to verify something like this because nobody was there. You can't prove it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know – You can't
use historical evidences to verify the truth of Christianity because nobody was there that is alive now, which isn't adequate proof for her, is what you mean.
Well, yeah, essentially, and she's saying, you know, I mean, whether Alexander the Great actually lived or died or his name wasn't even Alexander is no consequence to our lives now. But when you're talking about something of this magnitude, you can't, you know, you can't use that. That's not reliable.
Okay, let's play this out in a little different way because I have part of the question is whether historical evidences matter at all.
Right.
So, and the other one has to do with whether you can know anything about the past when you're significantly far removed from the past. What if you were feeling chest pains right now? What would you do?
I'd probably hit my chest.
You would hit your chest if you felt chest pains?
Yeah, I'd probably think I was having a heart attack.
Okay, let's say you were. What would you do?
Go to the hospital.
Why?
Because that's where they would take care of it.
How do you know that?
Because, you know, we've had people go there before. I mean, you know, it's...
Right, okay. I mean, these are...
Friends have gone, fathers have gone, you know.
Okay, great.
People you know have gone.
So there is a history there, isn't there?
Yeah.
There is a history... There are facts about the past that inform your behavior in the present, such that when there is a critical decision that you have to make about something that's vital, your life right now because you're feeling chest pains, you take the evidence of the past and you draw conclusions based on that evidence, and then you act in a way that you hope will save your life.
Right.
Okay, so, I mean, we're just stepping through this baby steps right now. So, the question is historical evidence important, the answer is what?
I would say yes.
Well, of course, everybody would have to say that.
Okay.
Because even your friend would answer the way you just answered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody makes decisions based on historical evidence. Now, somebody's going to say, well, this isn't the same thing because this is like present day. Well, in type, it is the same thing. There may be extenuating factors that make the conclusion not as valid in our case as in here. But what I want people to see, first of all, is in type, it's the same thing. So as a principle, historical evidences do matter. In fact, everything we do in our life, including the life and death decisions that we make every day, is based on evidence that come from history. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In fact, everything except for the split moment that I'm speaking now is past history. So anything you know because of the past. And it's the evidence of the past that gives you reason to believe either I or nay on any given point that affects your health, your survival every day.
Right, right.
So you can't just simply dismiss evidences, or she can't, and be fair, be reasonable, as if they don't matter. Now the question is, what kinds of evidences count, and what's at stake, all right? Now, I use the illustration of the heart attack because that's a weighty issue, right?
Right.
I mean, a lot's at stake. If you've got chest pains, you may die in the next 10 minutes. I mean, for 50% of the cases, the first evidence of a heart attack is death, you know. So that's a big deal, you know. This could be a real thing. So now we're talking about spiritual survival, not physical survival, but spiritual survival. Physical survival is like, you know, 80 years or so. Spiritual survival, arguably, is for eternity. So now we are offering, at least arguably, something that is infinitely more weighty, and that is our spiritual well-beings, based on what a lot of people have said about the spiritual realm. And I'm talking about the full range of mystics and spiritual leaders down through the ages. Here are a lot of, seem like pretty bright guy people that take the spiritual realm very seriously and think that it has long, long, long-term eternal ramifications. So we have good reason to believe that the spiritual questions are in the area of the most weighty ones we can ask, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it could be that there are no spiritual realities, but we would find that out after we examine the issues, might turn out that you are not having a heart attack.
Right.
But the issue of the heart attack, physically speaking, and the issue of spiritual realities, answering that question, in principle, have very weighty consequences. So we should give some attention to that. Now we have one of these guys, Jesus, who apparently made certain claims. And he claimed that, if you understand the claim that he made in the context of the culture, that he was the God who created all the universe, that he was the source of salvation for all people, and that he not only, this is the claim, he not only made this claim, but demonstrated power over the elements, calming the storm, power over sickness, healing, power over the demonic realm, casting out demons, and power over death itself, life and death itself, by raising the dead. And in fact, he, when he was killed, raised himself from the dead by his own prediction. Now, this is the Christian account.
Yeah,
okay.
That's
the case. Now, I'm not making a case for it yet. I'm just trying to put things step by step in their right perspective, all right?
Okay.
So given that history does matter, in principle, to all these questions, especially when we have weighty concerns, and that spiritual concerns, if there is a spiritual reality, are among the most weighty, and that one of the most revered, honored teachers of all time, at least allegedly claimed to be the God who made the world, to be the only source of salvation, and then allegedly did these things. Controlled the powers of nature, controlled spiritual powers, controlled life and death, such that he raised others and raised himself. Can you see that if those things actually did happen the way the text says they happened, they would weigh in heavily on behalf of this view being true about the most weighty things that we can think about?
Well, I can see that, yeah.
No, you don't even have to agree with the conclusion that Jesus actually said and did these things. I'm not even to that point yet.
Right.
I'm just simply saying, given this man's claim, and he's not just some bum at the bar, you know, who's drunk and just rattling off of some hallucination. This is a person that most people consider we should reckon with. And he has had a profound impact on civilization. Now, somebody said, well, other people have profound impact, other religious leaders. I say, fine, well, then maybe they should be considered too. The point I'm making is you cannot simply, it is not reasonable, it is not fair, it is not sound, it's not sensible, it's not smart to just dismiss this as if it doesn't matter. If spiritual things, if there's any reality to it, they matter more than anything. And if this guy's right about what he did, and he really did these things that would seem to substantiate the claims he made, then he's the guy to reckon with if it really happened. Then the question is not dismissing these things out of hand, frivolously, arrogantly, with your nose up in the air. But then the question is going to be, did these things really happen? And can we have any confidence that 2,000 years after they allegedly happened, we're getting the true story?
Right.
And that's a different kind of question.
Yeah.
Now, and that's a different call, really. And, of course, you know, we've covered some of this before, and there are a lot of books to deal with this. I'm just trying to deal with the flippancy of this individual. And this is why I've used some Columbo questions to try to start with what is familiar, heart attack, to get a person to realize they don't really believe that historical matters, evidence don't matter. Well, they do, certainly in the short term. They could be matter for life and death issues. So let's just come to agreement on that. Is that fair? Yes, that's fair. Okay. Well, then what about if there is a spiritual reality, can you see how that could be really important? Just like heart attacks could be really important? Yes, I can see that. Okay, well, then maybe we ought to think about whether anybody's correct about this, since it could be so important if it's really true. And it isn't like some screwball's hallucination. Most people in the history of the earth have had spiritual leanings of some sort. This seems to be something going on here. So maybe it's a good idea to figure it out. And then you take one of the greatest, by all accounts, one of the greatest spiritual leaders of all time, Jesus Christ, and you look at some of the claims he made and the things that he claimed to do, or people claim that he actually did. You say, golly, if that actually is true, this really weighs in heavily on behalf of the Christian view of the world. Of course, now we have the task of asking ourselves, are those claims true? Can we trust that what's been written then was handed down accurately? That's one part of the question. Can we trust that was written then, even if it was handed down accurately, was reported accurately by the people at the time? Were they lying? Were they did they have reason or motive to lie or to embellish or to change or to twist it? Did they have were they close enough to the events to be able to observe accurately these kinds of things? And so, is this good history? And you work from there. And, of course, I think those questions can be answered. But the bigger problem that you're facing is a person who's just dismissive of the entire enterprise.
Well, yeah, once we get past that dismissiveness, then you got to go down and you have to verify. The second part is, can we trust? I mean, because people get deceived by spiritual leaders all the time. You know, Jim Jones.
Sure.
You know, I mean, so people who are writing the gospel, they have a strong bias, so they're trying, you know.
Well, the question, now we're shifted into a different mode, okay? Do you realize in this, and I know we're kind of loosely role-playing this with your friend here, as if you were talking to your friend.
Yeah.
And if it, I think the biggest problem is to get it to this point where now we are considering, how do we know a true prophet from a false prophet, a charlatan from the real McCoy?
Mm-hmm.
That's a different kind of question. Once we've gotten past this foolishness, this haughty, arrogant kind of dismissal, this nose in the air like, oh, that's silly. You can't know anything from the past. I mean, this is a silly statement for somebody to make. And it shows to me that they're not taking the issue seriously. And this is why I want to walk them through getting these acknowledgments using the Columbo tactic, just so they could see, yeah, I guess, you know, in principle, these things could be important if they're true. So then you look at the legitimacy of it. And then you have to ask the question, you know, these guys who wrote about it were biased. Well, what does that mean?
Well, it means that they they wanted to believe this person was God or Jesus, or they wanted to start a new religion, and so they were promoting this.
Okay, now that's not bias. Now that's a conclusion about their motives. Bias is something that distorts their ability to report properly. Okay, that's the question here with bias. Now, if a person is going to say, well, they lied, well, then I'm going to ask, well, why would you think they lied? See, to say something is that somebody lied, and to say somebody's biased, those are two different kinds of things. A bias can distort something. Lie is a prevarication. You know, you're telling an untruth on purpose.
Right.
All right? So if you say, well, they had a bias. Well, what was their bias? Well, they believed in Jesus. They were followers of Jesus. Well, yes, they had a point of view, but that doesn't mean just because they were followers of Jesus that they were distorting the information. So what evidence is there from the records that they actually had reason to distort, or that they in fact did distort? And this is where it's useful that we have four different witnesses, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We have four different people from four different perspectives, at least two which are eyewitnesses, and two others that were close to eyewitnesses that are giving from different perspectives the account of the same life. And so you've got variation there that serves to corroborate. You have a number of different people saying this. And then you have this written in the presence of hostile witnesses. That is, there were people there that didn't believe this stuff, that were in a position to refute or repudiate the salient details. Like if Jesus' body was still in the tomb when they said Jesus was raised from the dead, you produce the body and that's the end of this. It just peters away. The fact is, they didn't produce the body because the body was missing. Then the question comes, and all historians acknowledge this, where did the body go? Well, the disciples stole it. Why would they steal it? Jesus was just crucified for doing nothing bad but promoting the kingdom of God. Why would they steal it and then promote the kingdom of God when they're going to get the same thing that Jesus got if they know that he's really dead? I mean, that doesn't make sense. And see, what I'm saying is it's very easy to offer the charge, this is biased. You can't trust what you know. This is a kind of unmitigated skepticism. You can't trust the past information. And my questions are going to be, why can't you trust it? Give me the specific reasons, and then let's see if those reasons actually hold water. These things have been gone over, Rich, with a fine-tooth comb. And even if people want to disbelieve after they look to the evidence, all right, that's their privilege or whatever. But you can't simply dismiss these things as if it's cockamamie to believe you know something happened 2,000 years ago. There are good reasons to believe certain things happened 2,000 years ago. And there are no good reasons to deny it. And therefore, skepticism, this unmitigated skepticism, that is mindless in itself.
So you're saying just outright and say, well, you're not there, you can't prove it, that's unmitigated?
No. When they say, I wasn't there, I can't prove it, that is an observation of fact, I wasn't there, and there was a conclusion based on the observation of fact, since I'm not there, I can't prove it. It does not follow that because you weren't there, you can't prove it. That is, you can't give sufficient evidence to show that it's so. It doesn't follow. I wasn't in New York 3 years and one day ago. But I have good reason to believe that the Twin Towers came down. In fact, I haven't been there since then. But I guarantee you there are no buildings sitting in that spot.
But it's one thing to have something now to do that. But from antiquity, it's a little bit different because, you know, if things have had to be translated, they had, you know.
Right. Well, that means there are more problems to deal with. And
right.
That doesn't mean that the problems are insurmountable. I'm simply looking at the statement, you weren't there, you can't prove it. And my response to that is that's false. Just because I'm not there doesn't mean I can't prove it. I can use certain reliable evidences to infer certain facts that I never saw. That's my point. Okay? Now, if that can be done with the Twin Towers, can that be done with the Battle at Gettysburg?
Oh, yeah.
150 years ago. All right. Well, can that be done with the Revolutionary War 200 years ago?
Yeah, I would say that.
Okay, well, then the same thing can be done with even events in antiquity, although you have to be mindful of the increased problems that one faces with longer periods of time. It doesn't mean it's impossible, is my point. You just have to pay attention to the problems and work through those. And like I said, this has been gone through with a fine-tooth comb. There are a lot of good reasons.
what is the reason for somebody like Karen Armstrong writing, I'm sure you've heard of the history
yes,
of God.
Yes, right.
She comes out with a different point of view than, you know.
Okay, but all right, now what? So Karen Armstrong has a different point of view than somebody else. You've got to look at her reasons for her point of view, just like you have for the reasons of the others, and you've got to come to a conclusion. Because
right.
Karen Armstrong says one thing, and R.C. Sproul says another, or Norm Geisler says another, doesn't mean that nobody's got an answer and nobody can know. It means you have a different point of view. That's it.
Right.
So they can't both be right. They could be both be wrong, but they can't both be right. And it's just a matter of looking at the evidence. What bothers me, and I have to end on this and go to break,
right.
is the sense of dismissal. Just this complete dismissal. You know, we don't have to talk to you because we don't want to hear what you have to say, and we feel comfortable in saying it's unbelievable because it happened in the past and you weren't there and you can't prove it. These are foolish reasons for dismissing something that is so important. That's my point. Rich, good talking to you. I hope you call back and kind of bring me up to date in a couple weeks on how your conversations have gone. I'll be back just in a moment. 1-800-227-5278. Lines open here on Stand to Reason.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Are you searching for a practical overview of the Bible? One that will help you put into context the covenants of the Old Testament, the call of Abraham, and the history of the developing nation of Israel? Struggling to understand how Jesus fits into the picture and how the perfect fulfillment of these covenants and promises worked out? Greg's teaching called The Bible Fast Forward will help you see the big picture of the Bible. You will be guided through God's plan for man and its fulfillment in Jesus. You'll also gain a better understanding of history that will make your personal Bible study time more meaningful. Put the pieces together today by ordering Stand to Reason's The Bible Fast Forward with study notes and review software for your PC. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON. It's available on audio cassette and CD. That's called The Bible Fast Forward, available online or by phone.
Get the fat out of your thinking, ladies and gentlemen. Trim down to fight and weight every Sunday, 3 to 5, here on Stand to Reason. That was a great call from Rich in, from Ida, Michigan. We've talked before. But the reason that from my perspective, that I think it was so helpful is that, as we've said many times in the show, my goal is not just to teach you what to think, but to teach you how to think. And what I want you to be able to see, friends, is how you work through a problem like that. And I'm sure that poor Rich heard the statement from his friend so many times, you weren't there, you can't prove it. And it never occurred to him that this simply doesn't follow, that simply because you weren't there doesn't mean you can't give good reasons to believe a thing is so. That's what I understand proof to be under these circumstances. Though some people, when they demand proof for spiritual things, they want more proof than they demand for anything else. And it's not enough to be beyond a reasonable doubt. They just want, you know, no possibility of being mistaken. Well, you can be mistaken on just about anything, ladies and gentlemen. And you can be mistaken by going to the wrong hospital for a heart attack. So it could have serious consequences, but it doesn't mean you're not within your rights to do that. Anyway, I want you to see the process. That's what I wanted you to get from that last call. Listen, just a reminder for those here in Southern California, actually in Capistrano Beach, on September 25th, which is, I guess, 2 weeks from tonight, I'll be at Faith Lutheran Church there in Capistrano Beach at 8:30 in the morning. And I'll be talking about setting the record straight, the Bible and homosexuality, and also same-sex marriage. So this is a double whammy, talking about what the Scripture says about homosexuality and then shifting over to address this policy issue the government is facing and we're facing as a culture, same-sex marriage. If you want to give them a call, the number there at Faith Lutheran in Capistrano Beach is 949, area code 496-1901. It's 496-1901. Hope to see you there, 8:30 in the morning, September 25th, Faith Lutheran, Capistrano Beach. All right, now time to go back to, oh, I guess Rich wasn't from Ida, Michigan. Instead, it's Tim from Ida, Michigan. Hello, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How you doing?
Fine. I saw Ida, Michigan up there. When I was talking to Rich, for some reason, I got it in my mind that he was the one from Ida. And I looked up here, and it's time for Tim. I said, no, Tim's in Ida, unless you're both in Ida, which I doubt.
No, I doubt it, yeah.
Yeah. How you doing?
Good. Our church is planning a retreat in October, and they know that I'm interested in your teaching materials, you know, and tactics and defending the faith and,
sure.
and so on. And they want to have a session of challenging me on some topic of debate.
Okay.
And I was going to maybe do the decision-making, the will of God topic.
All right.
And I'm trying to anticipate some counter-arguments. And one I've run into quite a few times is I always tell them that the New Testament, when it talks about, you know, the leading of the Spirit, it's usually in contrast to the works of the flesh, you know, and unrighteousness.
Mm-hmm.
And they always say, well, if the Spirit leads us into righteousness, how is that different in leading us in other areas of decision making? And I'm not sure how that would be different.
Okay, this is a good question. First of all, because this is one of the most misunderstood areas of one of the most misunderstood verses, especially as it applies to this area, the leading of the Spirit. A lot of people don't realize that the leading of the Spirit does not appear very often in the New Testament. In fact, it only appears two times in the letters, and we have a kind of variation in the Gospels where Jesus is led by the Spirit into the wilderness.
Right, right.
But when you look closely at those words there, it says the sense of the Greek words are that Jesus was compelled or drawn or driven into the wilderness, and arguably, since it's with Jesus, you've got something maybe a little unique going on there. When you see the phrase "led by the Spirit" used in the epistles, which clearly is for Christians, you see it used in a very, very limited kind of sense.
Right.
And it only occurs, and this is for the other listeners because I know you're familiar with this, it only occurs in two places, Galatians 5 and Romans 8. And the trouble with this verse or this phrase, led by the Spirit, is there is a 20th century understanding of what this phrase means, and then there's a biblical understanding, and the two don't match.
Mm-hmm.
And people talk about being led by the Spirit all the time, and what they mean is that there is an internal prompting that they interpret as a directive of some sort to act in a certain way, to do something in particular, not so much to act in a certain way, but like to act nice.
Right, right.
I don't mean it that way, but to do something. So people say, I was led by the Spirit to say this to him, or I was led by the Spirit to take this job, or I was led by the Spirit to date this girl. And so their understanding of being led by the Spirit, and this is where you need to make a clear distinction between the common parlance, and I think this will be important in your conversation.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, I admire you for taking this on.
Yeah.
Because this is a toughie, and I have maybe a little bit more advice to tell you, to give you after we answer this question on how you comport yourself on the dealing with the whole topic. But there is a big difference between the common parlance use of the term and what the Bible means. In common parlance, what we mean by it is God giving us some kind of directive that could be stated in propositional form. Date this girl, take this job, say these words. All right?
Right.
Even though the phenomenology of it may be obscure. In other words, it may not be a voice in our ear or voices in our head or something from a cloud. The way we receive the message could be very different. It could just be a deep sense or a nudge that we take to be a push from the Lord in this direction. In any event, however it presents itself to us, the phenomenon itself, we know what it means, that God is giving us a directive. All right? Now, that particular way, would you say that, by the way, that's a fair way of characterizing how people generally use the phrase.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, good. Okay, now you know when you go to the two texts in question, Galatians 5 passage and the Romans 8, it uses the phrase very differently there.
Right.
It is not using the phrase to communicate some kind of message. It is talking about the role of the Holy Spirit to produce holiness in our lives.
Right.
For example, in the Galatians, and it means the same in both passages, the Galatians passage, verse 16, chapter 5. But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desire of the flesh. Now, it uses the phrase walk by the Spirit. Next verse, you'll see it's in parallel with led by the Spirit. It's talking about the same thing. Walk by the Spirit, you will not carry out for the desire of the flesh, for the flesh sets itself its desire against the Spirit and the Spirit against the flesh, for these are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things that you please. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Then it gives categories of deeds of the flesh and then fruits of the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that when you're under the law, the flesh is in control, and this is what it produces. And when you are walking by the Spirit, that is led by the Spirit, it produces these virtues in your life. Now, it doesn't say what led by the Spirit is or walk by the Spirit is, except for that there is some involvement of the Spirit in our life on an ongoing basis that produces spiritual virtues. Can you see in this passage, and it's very similar in Romans 8,
mm-hmm.
Can you see in this passage that there is no indication of the communication of a message?
Right, yeah.
There is just the statement of the influence of the Spirit in somebody's life who is in communion in some sense with the Spirit, that is not under the law, the message of Galatians, but rather in the Spirit, that this produces these things in one's life. There's not a communication of messages. This is the particular thing that I'm concerned about in this teaching. Tim, it is people getting, for lack of a better word, messages. I certainly acknowledge the role of the Holy Spirit leading me. What I mean by that is what Paul means by that.
Right.
Helping to create a holy life in me. It is the work of the Spirit, strictly speaking, not leading in the sense that we are thinking of it, but taking me, you know. He takes me into a holy life. He brings me to a place of holiness by working and transforming me to defeat the works of the flesh and to produce the fruits of the Spirit. Now, obviously, you and I don't repudiate that work of the Spirit.
Right.
What we're saying is it isn't messaging. It isn't a text messaging, you know,
like people do.
It isn't hinting and pointing and pushing. And people say, well, don't you believe it being led by the Spirit? I said, yes, I believe what Paul means by that. I don't mean what you mean by that. I don't believe what you mean by that. And I want you to show me where in the text it teaches what you mean by that messaging, as it were, getting revelations in one way or another. And you're not going to find the idea that every Christian can expect to get these private messages from the text itself, certainly not in the area of decision-making, because there's no promise that God will make the decisions for you. Okay, now here's the clue, just to keep on point when you're discussing this with other people. What you are going to do, what your discussion is going to be about, all right, is the Scripture.
Right.
This is a safety valve for you. You are not saying to anybody what God can or can't do. You are not saying God can't give messages. You're not saying that God can't lead in the sense that they mean. You're not saying that God can't talk through a leprechaun from underneath your bed. You know, you're not limiting God at all.
Right.
This discussion ought not be about what God is capable of doing, because if you talk about that, then you've got to be open to leprechauns.
Yeah.
What this discussion is about what the Bible teaches. And therefore, any claims that are going to be made by the other side must be claims from the text, that is, in the context. All right?
Right.
And this is what you're going to insist on. You don't exegete experiences.
And that's usually the way they argue it is, too.
All the time.
Yeah.
They say, look, if what you say is right, explain this.
Yeah.
And then what they do is they give their experience. And my common response is, I don't exegete experiences. I only exegete the text, and you shouldn't exegete experiences too. Even if your experience is completely veridical, everything about it is true, just the way you characterize it, what does that mean for me as a Christian. It doesn't mean anything. The only thing that means something for me as a Christian is not your experience, but the teaching of the text. Now, if you can show me that your experience is taught in the text to be my experience, well, now you've got something to talk about. But if it's just your experience, I can just nod and say, hey, praise the Lord. Good for you, brother. But I can't come to any conclusions about what I ought to be experiencing as a Christian. Go ahead and give him heaven, Tim, okay? And give us a call when you have your session. Tell me how it goes. All right, that's the end of hour number one, friends. And, boy, that was quick. Hour number two coming right ahead. And I have some recommendations to give you, kind of in light of yesterday's memorial, from basically a report made for public. It's If Terror Strikes, Are You Ready? And about 10 or so questions that you can ask yourself and see if you know what to do under these circumstances. It could be useful. That coming up the second hour along with your calls. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Committed to clearing up mental smog. Good hygiene, too. Greg, giving you a piece of my mind today on Stand to Reason. Hour number two, and beginning to your call shortly, there are Orange County lines open in the 714 area code, 754-4150. And I mentioned that I was deeply moved last evening, so watching a memorial version. Actually, it was a documentary done by Rick Burns. I wonder if that's Ken Burns' brother. But it was a kind of Burns-esque in terms of its style and a very, very moving commentary. Not the newsy thing that some people saw on CNN last night, but rather a moving docudrama of sorts, documentary of 9/11. And, you know, I've been thinking about that ever since it happened, waiting now 3 years for the second shoe to drop. I am sure that there have been a number of things that have been averted that could have happened because of Homeland Security and vigilance. But I guess you don't have to be a genius to realize that there are gaping holes of necessity in our security because we live in a free country, for one. That's a good thing. And because of foolish things like political correctness and not profiling when we ought to be doing that and having fairly wide open borders, these leave liabilities and vulnerabilities for us as well. And so I'm just amazed that nothing more has happened. And my deep concern 2 weeks ago was that the RNC would be hit because it was the most likely time to get a lot of people in a gruesome attack, again in New York City. And I'm so glad it didn't happen. And my concern was at the time that you don't even have to get through the police lines to do that if you got a dirty bomb or a tactical nuke, and some have suggested those are out there. I don't know the truthfulness about that, but I've heard enough about it to make me concerned. You can just be floating in the harbor somewhere with a fishing boat and set off a tactical nuke and take out all of Manhattan. So that's the concern, and thank God last week ended without significant event. Of course, there were protesters and the like, but nothing regarding terrorism, and so I was glad for that, and this week now too, but you never know, and it's not just them. I mean, we're on the West Coast here, Los Angeles, but I live in Carson. It's kind of like halfway between downtown Los Angeles and the Los Angeles Harbor. All right, down in San Pedro. And, you can kind of triangulate and coordinate. And then you've got, Sin City and Hollywood up north a little bit. And then you've got Orange County down south. It's kind of like the epicenter for all of those things is Carson, California. That's probably where the bomb is aimed, you know, my house. And so I get concerned about this kind of thing. And that's why I read with interest the Parade magazine a couple of weeks ago. An article, I guess, prepared by or taken into consideration or researched with regards to the American Prepared Campaign. And the title is, If Terror Strikes, Are You Ready? Answering these 12 questions may help to save you and your family in a disaster. And I read them. I thought they were helpful. I'm going to read them to you and see if you get the answers right. And at the end, I'll give you an email address, not an email address, but a website address that you can go to get more information about how you might be prepared if, God forbid, the second shoe does drop and we get hit with something gruesome. Here's the first. There are 12 questions. First, true or false, you're near an explosion. You should cover your nose and mouth with a cotton T-shirt or dust mask right away. True or false? Right? True. Covering your nose and mouth can help avoid exposure to toxic particles or radioactive dust. Okay, that's a good idea. That's pretty straightforward. Cover your mouth and nose if you hear an explosion. It's a good idea. You do that kind of, instinctively anyway. Okay? Two. Which best describes a dirty bomb? Now, I mentioned a dirty bomb just a moment ago. Do you know what it is? Four choices. A miniature nuclear device. Second choice. An explosive device that releases chemicals. Third choice. An explosive device that releases a biological agent. And fourth choice. An explosive device that spreads radioactive materials over a specific area. Answer D, a dirty bomb spreads radioactive materials, okay? It's not the force of the bomb that hurts. It's the radioactive materials that it's the after effects that it's supposed to hurt. Of course, if it was chemicals or biological agent, that would be nasty too. But strictly speaking, that's a dirty bomb. Three, true or false, a dirty bomb will kill everyone within 5 miles and make buildings uninhabitable for years. I got this one wrong, actually. Remember, that dirty bomb is an explosive device that spreads radioactive materials. Will it kill everyone within 5 miles and make buildings uninhabitable for years? The answer is false. As with any bomb, people will likely be killed by the initial blast, and some will develop radiation sickness, but how dangerous the bomb is and if buildings are contaminated depends on how much radioactive material was used. Now, that makes sense, although I think the false answer is misleading. The answer should be, well, it depends on how much radioactive material, and then you'd see. Fourth question. If there is an explosion that may be a dirty bomb or other radiological incident, that's radioactive material, or if authorities warn a radiation release nearby, where is the best shelter? Two choices, high up in a building, low down in a basement or cellar. Okay, the answer is B, being sheltered by a thick wall and being below ground offers more protection. Your best option is a windowless room you can seal off with enough air for several hours. So get down low if there's a radiological blast of some sort. I remember when we were in the military, we learned how to deal with that. You know, they got us all together and they said, an atomic bomb gets dropped. Okay, you just get into a ditch. You drop your head down between your legs. We're all doing this, you know. We're all GIs. Feet flat on the ground. We're all going through. And then they say, kiss your butt goodbye. You know, that's it. That's the hope you have. Anyway, get low. That's the idea. Let's see. Five, the warning signs of a chemical attack include people suddenly become violently ill, choking or passing out. If you see this, what's the first thing to do? Okay, so a chemical attack, violent illness, choking, passing out. What do you do? Leave the area as fast as possible, or cover your mouth and nose with fabric, then run away, or head for a basement and seal all doors and windows, or cover your nose and mouth and wait for emergency personnel to arrive to be decontaminated. The answer there is hopefully the obvious one. A, leave the area as fast as possible. Get out of there. I guess you can cover your mouth and nose if you like, but get out of there. Unlike an explosion with debris, dust masks or cotton T-shirts won't protect in a chemical attack. That's interesting. Okay, six, in the event of biological attack, which is not true, a biological attack may not be immediately obvious. During a biological attack, germs or other substances that can make you sick are released. C, you can become sick by inhaling, eating, or touching a biological agent. D, this should be obvious, all biological agents create contagious diseases. Well, the first three are obviously true, it seems to me. The last one is false. They don't all create contagious diseases. They may cause a disease in you, but others might not be able to catch it from you. Seven, unlike an explosion, a biological attack may not be immediately obvious. If you see signs of unusual illness or biological attack is reported on the radio or TV, where is the safest place to seek shelter? Same options as the nuclear attack. High up in a building or low down in a basement or cellar? Now, here's the problem. The answer is biological agents will settle on the ground. So the higher up you can get, the better. So if it's radiological, get in the basement. If it's biological, get in the top story of the building. And if you can't tell the difference, get out of there as soon as possible, I guess is the best thing. In the event of explosion or natural disaster such as tornado or hurricane, you may become trapped under debris. Which of the following steps is the worst one can take to alert rescuers? Tap on a pipe or a wall, use a flashlight, or shout. What's the worst thing you could do? C, shout. They got to be wrong about this. Shout only as a last resort. You can inhale dangerous dust. Instead, you should try to keep your nose and mouth covered. You got to be kidding me. Listen, if I'm under a building and somebody's walking about, I'm not going to cover my mouth and then tap on a pipe. I'm going to yell. Anyway, that's their advice. 9, which statement is false about sheltering during an emergency? So there's 4 statements. Which one is false? First, you may need to create your own shelter in your home or workplace. 2, shelters must accept pets. 3, when evacuating to a community shelter, bring a disaster supply kit. And 4, you may be told to shelter where you are in a chemical attack, even if you're in the area of the attack. Well, my chuckle gave it away. B, pets are not permitted in emergency shelters for health reasons, unless it's a PETA shelter, I guess. A hotel or motel that accepts pets may be an alternative. Are you kidding me? So you have an explosion, you get on the phone, and you start calling around pet motels to find a place for your pet. 10, how can you find or create safe drinking water? Boil it for 3 to 5 minutes, add 16 drops of bleach per gallon, use water from a radiator, use water from a hot water heater. The answer is, answers A, B, and D. So this was, more than one. Radiators are never a safe source of drinking water, but the others are. Boiling is the safest method. But adding 1/8 teaspoon of unscented bleach can treat a gallon of water but won't kill parasites. Okay, 11, we're getting to the end here. Have you prepared a family communications disaster plan that includes a meeting place away from your home, work, or school, a family contact person in another city or town, and a list of phone numbers for each family member? Oh, it's tough. Yes or no? No. Most of you are going to say no, but you should, and this is one of their most helpful recommendations. Frankly, all the other stuff is like, go to the top of the building, go to the basement, cover your nose, run out of there, don't shout. Who knows what? Things are pretty radical at that point, and how are you going to know to keep all the rules straight? But this one's good. A good disaster plan should be flexible with many different ways to communicate. Local phone lines may be overwhelmed, so have an out-of-town person you can call to check in with who can relay messages. You should have a child's school phone number and know what the school disaster plan is. Establishing 2 family meeting sites, a primary and a backup, and who will be responsible for locating which children in advance also can be helpful. Okay, finally, the last thing. What should you have in an emergency kit? Now, the answer here is obvious. All of the above. Food and water, first aid kit, battery-powered radio, flashlight, and extra batteries, and other essentials such as prescription medications. Well, there you have it. I hope some of that was helpful to you. But if you want to get a full list of information on how you can be prepared, here's the website, www.americapprepared.org. www.americaprepared.org. And like all insurance policies, and being prepared like this is a kind of insurance policy, the best thing is you never have to cash it in. And we hope that that's the case. All right. Let's go to our phones. And let's see, we got Pat. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Pat. How are you?
Good afternoon, Greg.
Good afternoon, sir.
Last hour you were talking about historical evidences.
Right.
Dealing to history. I got to confess, I didn't hear the whole call.
Mm-hmm.
But it got me thinking about a book that I've just finished, and that's C.S. Lewis's Miracles.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, I would say the first chapter, he talks about, if you don't mind, can I give a short quote?
Short one. Lewis is not bad, so if you're a good reader, go ahead.
Many people think one can decide whether a miracle occurred in the past by examining the evidence, according to the ordinary rules of historical inquiry. But the ordinary rules cannot be worked out until we have decided whether miracles are possible. If they are possible but immensely improbable, then the only mathematical demonstration of evidence will convince us. And since history never provides the degree of evidence for any event, history can never convince us that a miracle has occurred. And then he says, the result of our historical inquiries thus depends on the philosophical views which we have been holding before we even begin to look at the evidence. The philosophical question, therefore, must come first.
Yeah, okay. Was there more?
Well, he does say that he gives an example of why this is the case, and then he concludes that those who assume that miracles cannot happen are merely wishing their time by looking into the text. Excuse me, wasting their time.
Mm-hmm.
And we know in advance what results they will find, for they have begun by begging the question. It seems to me that this was the argument that Dr. Bonson was making against Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
On historical evidences versus, you know, the presuppositional method.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, Bonson, in that particular case, I think that presuppositions certainly weigh in here. But let's look at Pat. If you and I were walking on the street and you had no ideas about miracles at all, just nothing, but you knew about the uniformity of natural causes and characteristically. That natural causes are uniform, and you knew what a miracle was. And then you saw something, you saw a miracle. You saw me produce I'm trying to think of an illustration here. You saw a guy die, and then you saw him embalmed, and then as you're at his wake, at his funeral, he gets the body has been embalmed already. Then he gets up out of the casket. You don't have to go through any philosophic gymnastics at that point to decide whether or not it's possible that miracles happen when, in fact, you see one yourself that is bona fide and irrefutable from your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It is the fact of the miracle that makes it, that allows you to believe in the possibility of the miracle. I'm not sure how else to put it.
It's interesting that Lewis said before the passage I read, he stated, if immediate experiences cannot prove or disprove the miraculous, which implied in that, he does say that if you were to see a miracle, let's say somebody that's in the neurophysiology or the neurosciences, mind sciences, and they're saying, wait a minute, we can explain this one day. You know, they give an ad hoc defense that, well, it certainly wasn't a miracle because my philosophical presupposition is naturalism and miracles can't even begin.
Well, there's no question.
I'll explain it in some other way.
Yes, there's no question that philosophic presuppositions can influence things, okay?
So is Lewis right in saying that we must deal with that first before we talk about any historical evidence, period?
No, this is very similar to the one-step or two-step approach in proving Christianity. The one-step approach is that you can go to Jesus directly and start with Jesus and make the case for Christianity there.
Right.
The two-step approach is first you have to prove that there is a God before that you can prove that Jesus is the God that there is.
Right.
All right. And so there's debate in apologetic circles.
Sure.
I think both are valid, and I don't see why you can't do a one-step approach. If you don't know whether there is a God, encountering somebody like Jesus who claims to be that God and gives evidence that we can believe that he is telling the truth there seems to me to establish in itself that both at the same time there is a God and Jesus is he.
Right.
You see, and I don't see the problem there quite.
What's your take on the Luke 16 passage with Lazarus and the rich man, and you have Jesus saying in the conclusion of this, well, some say a parable, not a parable.
Right.
And Jesus said, unless they first believe in the prophets, you know, in the Old Testament, they will not even begin to believe that somebody rises from the dead.
Well, if they can't take the testimony of the prophets, I think what Jesus is pointing out is they've already made up their minds about certain things. And therefore, they're not going to believe even if somebody rises from the dead. And the irony is that Lazarus was the name of the person in this story or parable, whatever. But there actually was a real Lazarus that was raised from the dead, and it still didn't purchase the belief of those who saw the resurrection.
Right.
The Pharisees, for example, didn't believe, and indeed they tried to kill Lazarus that Jesus had raised because he was walking evidence of living, breathing evidence of Jesus' messianic office. So here
you have Jews that had direct access, immediate experience of this risen Lazarus, and they still didn't believe because?
Well, the question isn't whether people can gainsay irrefutable evidence.
Okay.
They can. People can have their – it's like Dead Men Do Bleed. I don't know if you've heard that story,
yeah.
You know. But the guy said, you know, I'm dead, I'm dead. And everybody said, you're not dead, you're alive. And then finally the doctor said, well, dead men bleed? He goes, no. And so he stuck him with a pin and he started to bleed. He goes, well, I guess dead men do bleed. In other words, they start out with a conviction, and nothing will sway them from this conviction regardless of the evidence. Now, that's the power of presuppositions. Yeah. And there certainly are people who have presuppositions that are so deeply ingrained, even if a man rises from the dead, they will not accept it. All right. There's no question about that. Your question, though, is it, and the Lewis's question is whether it is that always going to be the case that and this would go back to Greg Bonson and the presuppositionalist, before you can give evidence for something like a resurrection, you've got to deal with the presuppositions that are hostile. And I think I don't think that's necessary. I think sometimes you can prove that a miracle happens before you prove that miracles are possible. And it's demonstrating the miracle that is the evidence that miracles are possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the best I can do on that one.
Okay. I want to let your listeners know, if you haven't already given a plug for it, speaking of C.S. Lewis, starting this Wednesday night, is the PBS special on the question of God, C.S. Lewis versus Freud.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, PBS, Wednesday night, I think it's at 8. Listeners can check their local.
Yeah,
but
okay.
It's basically...
Lewis versus Freud?
From Dr. Armand Nicolai's book, The Question of God, which is C.S. Lewis debates Sigmund Freud on the big issues of life, love, sex, meaning of life, and what have you.
Right.
So, and it's a two-parter. Begins this Wednesday and follows up the following.
Okay, great. Thanks for the tip. And it's
okay.
Good to talk to you again, Pat.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye now. Greg Kokel, time for a break. And lines open 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code 754-4150. Stay with us. I'll be right back.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel, giving you something worth thinking about every weekend, Sundays 3 to 5, here on Stand to Reason. And let's see, in 2 weeks about, September 25th, is that a Saturday? Okay, 8 a.m. Saturday morning, Faith Lutheran Church in Capistrano Beach. If you're within striking distance, actually it'll be 8:30. And I'll be talking, I think, in two sessions on setting the record straight, the Bible and homosexuality, and then in the second session, same-sex marriage. So I start out dealing with the question of what the Bible says about homosexuality. And, you know, for Christians, especially when you're talking with a Christian group, there's so much confusion on this issue in some circles that you really need to reset somebody's moral compass. And the way to do that is with Scripture when you're dealing with Christians. And so I will be doing that in the first session. And then I'll be talking talking about what are we to do and how are we to approach this whole issue of same-sex marriage. I think we should approach it as a policy issue and not beat people over the head with the Bible. But there's a different tack to take, and I'll be talking about that on that that Saturday morning. That's September 25th, Faith Lutheran Church of Capistrano Beach, 8:30 in the morning. Let me give you the phone number to call if you'd like instructions on how to get there. 949 area code. excuse me. The number is 496-1901. 949-496-1901, Faith Lutheran Church, 8:30, Saturday morning, September 25th, on the issue of homosexuality and same-sex marriage. All right, let's get back to the phone calls. And another call from Michigan. Nathan, welcome to the show. Flint, Michigan, right?
Yes.
Where is Flint? Is that north of Lansing?
It's just east of Lansing.
Just east of Lansing. Are you a suburb of Detroit or a little further removed from Detroit to be a suburb?
It's just about an hour north or so.
Okay.
Detroit.
Because I went to school in East Lansing at Michigan State many, many moons ago.
Okay.
And I'm going to be in Michigan next week at Holland, Michigan, but I think that's pretty far from you.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
I'm flying into Grand Rapids, and then I'm speaking in Holland. And you have to look at our website at str.org, and I think the details are there.
Okay.
Okay. What's on your mind today, Nathan?
I just had a question regarding in kind of the day-to-day evangelism or witnessing with people. And
mm-hmm.
when you kind of have, you know, an apologetic mindset with sometimes when you're speaking with people and you're dealing with certain objections, and they kind of, you know, you're dealing with them, but at the same time, you know, I guess my question is, how do you avoid going down kind of apologetic rabbit trails with people? Kind of a link off your website I got to was, like, Ray Comfort, and he gives the, you know, the bad news, good news type of thing.
Right.
It kind of says that in certain situations you kind of get an apologetic gymnastics where you
right.
really get to the central issue. And certain people, you know, in my circle of influence that I speak with, you know, you're kind of in the same, you know, you're still dealing with certain things. I'm kind of wondering how can you kind of strike a balance?
Yeah, let me give you an illustration. Just recently I rewired my garage because I was getting it kind of beefed up for some tools that I purchased, and I had to take everything off the walls of my garage, and you know, because I pegboard and everything, and everything got pushed towards the middle, basically. And that garage was a mess, and it was almost impossible to get from the outside of the house to the inside of the house through the garage because there's no pathway. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I got things squared away, pretty soon we got some things moved around, and I was able to make a pathway. There are a lot of other things still in the garage that could be cleaned out. And eventually have gotten cleaned out, but they didn't need to be cleaned out to get to the back door. Sometimes when you're witnessing, you find the same thing. Sometimes there is no path to the back door through the garage. You got to clear some things out to make a path.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to clear everything out to make a path. There can be still some things that are lingering that may be questions that don't have to be resolved before people give a consideration to the gospel. Earlier in the show, the first hour, I had a gentleman called Rich, and he asked a question because he's been having kind of a running fight with a gal who's a friend of his that dismisses Christianity because she says you can't know anything that's true about the past. Now, of course, you can see if this woman has this point of view, she's not even going to be considering any gospel message that has to do with Christianity, the basic gospel like Ray Comfort offers, and we're really in favor of his stuff. He gives the law first, and then he gives the bad news first, and then the good news, to put it simply. We agree with that. But you can't, unless you know, if they don't even consider the legitimacy of that kind of thing, you're not even going to get started. You can't get to the back door.
Right.
Through the garage, as it were. So what we talked about is how you clear that piece of garbage out of the way so that you can get to where you need to go. And sometimes you're just going to have to clear some stuff out. Now, how much do you have to clear out? That's a judgment call, Nathan. And there's no, you know, magic bullet on there. You're just going to have to make the call yourself. You're going to have to be thinking and praying and asking for wisdom. You know, when I encounter somebody, I start talking with them. I try to, as a good ambassador, I'm open for any occasion of getting in a conversation about Christianity. And so I'm looking for an opportunity. But when something begins to open up, that's when I shoot up a prayer. Lord, give me wisdom. Help me to do well here to maneuver. Help me to deal with what I have to deal with and no more. I mean, I don't say all those words. It's just basic, Lord, help me, give me wisdom. But that's the point. When you're in a circumstance like that, it's hard to tell. And there's nothing tidy about it. Sometimes you do too much of the apologetics gymnastics. Sometimes you don't do enough. You know, it's hard to tell. And this is why I'm glad that I have a sovereign God that is over all of this process, and it doesn't all depend on me. You just have to kind of figure it out as you go along. If you sense that there's something that's really in the way, then you address it. But you don't make it a seminar on apologetics.
Right.
You want to get to the point, you want to get to Jesus as soon as possible and talk about those concerns. Sometimes I never get to Jesus. You know, sometimes I get to him real quickly. You never know. Sometimes I'm just, you know, clearing the garage out, and I make a pathway halfway to the door so that when that person talks to you next time, you can clear out a couple more so maybe the third person can get him to the door. Sometimes that's your job as an ambassador, just clearing the path, partially, and maybe God will use somebody else to clear it even more. That's why I don't have it as a goal to get a person to the foot of the cross every time I talk to them. My goal is to – do you know what my goal is? I don't know if you follow Standard Reason to know my modest goal.
Right, just give them something to think about. Right?
Yeah, I put a stone in their shoe.
Right.
That's
right.
It. And, you know, and if I can get to, you know, if I can get, I don't have to hit home runs. I don't even have to get on base, really. I just got to get up to bat. That's what my goal is. Get up to bat and start swinging.
Yeah, you know,
and then see where the Lord takes
tough mindset, Greg, sometimes because the, you know, the church really now with the, you know, the mentality kind of, you know, the church growth and that kind of thing is the mentality is kind of like, you know, how many people, you know, and I'm sure it has always been this way, but. You know, the goal of numbers of people getting people
right.
in, and it seems in my conversations that, you know, I question sometimes, you know, if anybody's talking to anyone, because everybody claims that, you know, you just bring someone to church and all of a sudden they start going to church.
That's a decision.
You know, 90% of the people you speak with who are non-Christians
mm-hmm.
have numerous objections,
mm-hmm.
and they're not just going to go to church, walk in, and you know.
Yeah. Well, so what counts for me is baptisms. I mean, that's where I think people, if people are communicated with accurately, they're informed accurately about what baptism is. Baptism is usually the dividing line between the believer and the non-believer. A person who's willing to go forward in public and get baptized usually is making a real, genuine commitment. Not just somebody who walks down in front and has an emotional experience while the organ's playing or the piano or the rock band is playing or whatever. After an emotional appeal by a youth leader or something like that, because I don't know what those people are coming down for, to be honest with you. You know, I don't know what message has been spoken. In a lot of the churches, they can get a lot of decisions because the message is a weeny message.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really given the real McCoy. You know, what I want is real decisions, and this is why I do not hurry people to the foot of the cross. I am not quick to give them Jesus and get them to pray. I want people to understand exactly what they're doing when they make a commitment not to receive Christ, because I'm not so concerned in people receiving Christ. I'm concerned with people following Jesus, and I want people to understand what that entails, to be a follower of Jesus Christ, and it takes a lot more than receiving Christ. And by the way, with the emphasis on following Christ then, it's not like, okay, you get them to say the prayer and then it's over with. They're in. They're safe. You know, what happens after that? Well, it's secondary as long as they've said the prayer. I don't care about them saying the prayer. I want them to be believers in Jesus, and being a believer in Jesus entails following him. And so if that takes a while before people understand enough to make the move, that's fine. It took me a couple of years of thinking about this at one level or another before finally in September 28, 1973, and I guess my spiritual birthday is coming up pretty soon, I said a prayer, but I was making a commitment to follow Jesus, and I understood quite a bit of what that entailed. I want other people to do the same. So I don't hurry them to the foot of the cross with some kind of gimmickry or some kind of prayer or just, you know, the steps to peace with Jesus or whatever. These four steps, four laws, three steps booklets, they were developed in the 50s. The world has changed dramatically since then. And even though they may capture the heart of what the gospel entails, generally a whole lot of additional work has to be done before these laws, rules, steps are meaningful to any person. All righty?
Yeah, I really appreciate that answer, Greg.
Okay, Nathan, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Take care, buddy, in Flint, Michigan. Okay, 1-800-227-5278. Those lines are wide open, and generally those are the ones that are full up. So if you've been trying to get in the last hour and a half and haven't been able to, got a full open line for you there. Let's go to Larry. And Larry, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, my question is on the decision-making and will of God.
Uh-huh.
One question that comes up is, and I kind of took a general look at it, was like the casting of lots in Acts, where they said, Acts 1.
Yeah, where they chose the remaining leader, huh?
Right, to replace Judas. They prayed and said, you know the hearts of all men, show us which one of these you have chosen, and they drew lots.
Right.
And kind of with that is in Proverbs where it says the lot is cast
into the heap, but every decision
the
is
Lord.
Of the Lord, right.
And just on top of that, you know, I did kind of a search on lots, and throughout the Old Testament, and this is aside from the Urim and Thummim,
yeah.
There seems to be a lot of mention of casting of lots. And
How many did you find, just out of curiosity? I've actually never done that, though there are a number of what could be called circumstantial signs, of which casting lots or Urim and Thummim would be another example.
Right, right.
A number of these things happen.
Uh-huh.
So what we...
29 results.
Yeah, 29 results?
Including Acts, the only New Testament one is Acts.
That's right.
So that's 28.
Right.
And that would be references
to Lot, to casting lots,
lot.
And the actual casting of lots. Is that correct?
Yes.
And because I know, like when Moses, there was a wandering in the wilderness, and then they went to take the land. There was a casting of lots that
mm-hmm.
to find the person that Achan who had taken the And so this was one method that the people used to determine what God was indicating.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one of them. I was looking forward to it.
Okay, so the question then is,
how does that relate to the teaching that that's not what the Bible teaches us to how to make decisions?
Okay, good. Here's how it relates. There is no question in my mind that in the Old Testament there were examples of these circumstantial signs, of which casting of lots was just one of them. That's kind of like a fleece, and we see in the book of Judges, chapter 6, we see Gideon and his fleece and that kind of thing happening there.
I've used that example from you also. In the case of Joshua, though, he's explicitly told, and
Gideon.
On top of that, he kind of goes...
Right, yeah, and Gideon was way out of bounds in that particular case, but there are other circumstantial signs that are in the Old Testament. The question that I would ask is this: what is the application of that for New Testament times? Do the fact that some people actually had circumstantial signs to get direction from God in the Old Testament teach us that we are to have circumstantial signs to guide us about what God wants us to do? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced at all that because there are circumstances where this happens in the Old Testament, that is teaching that that's what we are to do in the New Testament. We see one example of that in the book of Acts. We see no other circumstantial signs that I know of either in the book of Acts or any other writings in the New Testament, as if this is affirming what we are supposed to do. We see in the Old Testament a whole bunch of occasions where decisions were made without circumstantial signs, but rather they were made based on the scriptures and the guidance God gave through his written word. Even in the book of Acts, which we see, by the way, emphasized in the New Testament, I don't know anybody nowadays, even the most extreme Pentecostal, who believes in all these signs and everything, who are casting lots for anything.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not applying this kind of thing in that way.
Yeah.
I did give some insight. If you're going to use a circumstantial sign, I suggested in the teaching on decision-making the will of God how to do that so you can't get a false positive.
Right, right, yeah.
That means you should have a circumstantial sign for yes and a circumstantial sign for no. They should be supernatural signs so that there's no possibility they could be mistaken, and then you will know whether God's going to speak to you through the sign. So you could say, God, if you want me to take this job, elevate the piano. If you don't want me to take the job, elevate the sofa.
Right.
if neither elevate, then you know God isn't going to speak to you through circumstantial signs.
Right.
I actually don't think that's the way God works, generally speaking, though there were some exceptional cases in the Old Testament. I don't think that's the way it works in the New Testament at all. And that's why if you want to be open to this, then let's give – God's not, you know, restricted to raise the sofa or the TV or whatever. He can do either. So let's give him a test that makes it impossible for us to be mistaken.
Yeah, I agree. You could argue that. But on the other side, in the cast in lots, there's no miracle involved. It's just you do. And I agree, nobody.
Okay, now there is a question in that. The casting of lots in Acts chapter 1 is an interesting one because there is some question. Some debate, I don't know, it has some merit, and I don't know where I stand in it, to be honest with you, as to whether it was appropriate for them to cast lots like that. Because some people would argue that Paul was the 12th disciple, that God chose him himself sovereignly. They didn't have to cast lots like that. But you notice something else that was interesting in the Acts circumstance, in the Acts occasion when they cast lots. They didn't just cast lots, did they?
They prayed. Yeah.
Well, no, there's more than that.
They prayed, and you know the hearts. They presented two men.
Well, how'd they get two men? Why'd they present 50? Or why'd they present any man at all?
Well, they had some requirements.
Whoa, slow down. This is important.
Yeah.
They had some requirements. In fact, it says here, it is therefore necessary that of the men who have accompanied us all the time, one requirement, that the Lord Jesus went out among us, beginning with the baptism of John, until the day that he was taken up from us, one of these should become a witness with us of his resurrection. So they had standards. They didn't just say, God, tell us who to pick.
Yeah.
What they did is they had standards that were guidelines for them, and when they applied the standards that they thought were appropriate standards, somebody's been with us the entire time, part of the inner group, but and also a witness of the resurrection, they had two people left. They had whittled it down to two.
Yeah.
So what did they do? They flipped a coin.
Yeah.
That's what they did. They didn't have a coin. They drew straws or whatever. They cast a lot, but it's the same thing. It's heads or tails.
Yeah.
It's one or the other. They flipped a coin and trusted that God would be in the decision-making there.
And really, probably either one would have.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, arguably.
Yeah.
The point I'm making is this is not akin to what people are doing today.
Yeah.
They're saying, God must make all my decisions for me, and so I'm going to go with the little internal nudgings, and I'm going to bring all of these little incidents together and see how they all tie together. This implies that God has taken his will and put it in code and then has asked us to decipher the code, essentially.
Right.
And this is just silly.
Yeah.
I mean, that God would do that kind of thing, and there's no scriptural evidence for that. If they want to do it the same way they did it in the Bible, then let them, you know, cast lots. Let them find their mates by having their parents choose. I mean, let's do it just the way they did it in the Bible.
That's a great point. One last thing is if I do some research, it may end up that all the Old Testament accounts may be, you know, just the prophets or a certain type of person.
That's right. It's very likely that this is a very unique situation, which is another point that can be made.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Take a look at those accounts because I think you'll find that that's the case. Are we to conclude, even from the Old Testament accounts, that this is the way the standard Jew made his decisions as a follower of the God of Israel?
Right.
I don't think so.
Okay,
Larry. Thanks a lot for the call. And got to go to break, but let me just remind you, we are wide open on calls here. We got 20 minutes before the show's over, so give us a ring, 1-800-227-5278, if you'd like to talk with me. Rare circumstance, lines wide open, in the 714 area code 754-4150 here on Stand to Reason.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Are you searching for a practical overview of the Bible? One that will help you put into context the covenants of the Old Testament, the call of Abraham, and the history of the developing nation of Israel? Struggling to understand how Jesus fits into the picture and how the perfect fulfillment of these covenants and promises worked out? Greg's teaching called The Bible Fast Forward will help you see the big picture of the Bible. You will be guided through God's plan for man and its fulfillment in Jesus. You'll also gain a better understanding of history that will make your personal Bible study time more meaningful. Put the pieces together today by ordering Stand to Reason's The Bible Fast Forward with study notes and review software for your PC. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON. It's available on audio cassette and CD. That's called The Bible Fast Forward, available online or by phone.
Greg Kokel back at you here. Kind of quiet. 1-800-227-5278. In the 714 area code 754-4150. Give me a call. You want to chat? Wide open. But I do have something to say in the absence of callers here. And this is one of the cutest things that I've seen in a long time. And it really makes a great point. This comes from... where does it come from? I had this email to me. It's a meditation by Russ. Let's see. Apparently, this happened. Let me just read it to you. It's about. All right. In February 1985, I woke up in a hospital bed in Boston, Massachusetts. I couldn't see very well, and I couldn't move much. But boy, could I ever hear! I heard a terrifying discussion. Then that I will never, ever forget. This comes from a freelance writer in St. Petersburg, Florida, who was nearly killed by her ex-husband. So this is a true story, all right? Around the end of my bed were a school of doctors in their white coats planning when to disconnect my ventilator and feeding tube. I immediately started screaming, "I'm here!" But nobody heard me. They did notice my sudden agitation. They heavily sedated me. For a time, every time I woke up, I would make as much noise and move as much as I could to show them that I was in there. I guess she was in a coma. And they would, in response, heavily sedate me. I then started spelling the same word in the air. Don't. 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 The doctors decided that the letters I was spelling in the air were repetitive seizure activity and just happened to occur most often when they were in my room discussing killing me. I even took to writing them backwards to make it easy for them to read. And their response was to sedate me even more. But the nursing staff began to believe I was really and truly with them. One in particular started bringing in a clipboard and a broken pen when she talked to me. She would put ink on my fingers, the clipboard under my right hand, and then ask me yes and no questions in the beginning. With her, I secretly progressed to answering in sentence fragments. However, by doctor's orders, she was not allowed to document in my file what she was doing and that I was giving meaningful responses. But she did save my inky answer sheets and recorded the questions she asked. She got into a lot of trouble for that. Yet, it earned me a final conference where the doctors had to prove to the nursing staff for political reasons that all my communication was just agitation and seizures. At that meeting, my then-husband, who was a doctor siding with the other doctors who wanted to let me die, held that clipboard, which was my lifeline, up in the air in front of me. He was not going to make it easy. The purpose was to prove that the nurses were basically hallucinating and that I was really and truly brain dead. To prove I could not communicate, he then put ink on my fingers and asked while laughing, "There isn't anything you want to tell us, is there?" In response, I spelled out D-I-V-O-R-C-E. Y-O-U, divorce you. The laughter got very nervous then. The doctors called for medication because I was obviously having a seizure. When the nurse who used the board first with me said, let me try, and what do you need to tell us today, she asked, I spelled out, same thing, divorce him, exclamation point, four times. There was never a question after that about whether I was in there or not. Then they said I couldn't breathe on my own, and I could. Then they said I couldn't learn to eat again on my own, and I did. Then they said therapy wasn't important, and it was. Then they said I would be dead within a year in 1985. This is 2003. They also said I would never have a meaningful mental function again, yet I earned another master's degree only a few years later. Here's the real medical corker, though. They also said at the time that I was permanently sterile. That was a cause of great grief for me because for then, as I had very much wanted to bear and raise a child, but it turned out my son, who is here in this service today, was born at the end of that year. It turned out that I was actually pregnant at the very moment they were telling me I was sterile. A simple test at the time could have established that. A test they didn't think they needed to do, so they didn't. My point is, and we're closing with this, my point is that the medical and legal staff of the hard of the world-renowned hospital were wrong and didn't listen and made startling assumptions about the quality of life for the disabled community I had joined. In their eyes, I only had two options then, full recovery or a lovely hospice death. I did spend time in a hospice against my will, fighting to get to my OBGYN appointments, but that is the stuff of another story. Leave it to say that it was beyond them that most of us, especially the disabled community, live full lives in between physical perfection and death. Interesting. All right, back to the phones. Doug, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I teach some high school kids at Hollywood Prez, and
okay.
One of them came up with a real good stumper for me, and I thought I'd pass it on to you and see if you could help me out.
All right.
We were talking about ethics at the time.
All right.
And we had already gone over an excuse for why it would be justified to go to war even though innocent people die from collateral damage.
Correct.
That basically, in a way, the end justify the means. It's a pragmatic argument that though a bomb may kill a few, say in the case of Nagasaki or in the case of Iraq, the overall freedom people attain and the overall lives will probably be saved.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we justify this war, is that in the end, more lives need to be saved and freed than those it would cost with a bombing, because if you bomb to save lives, it ends up costing more.
Uh-huh. Of course, that's not the circumstance we're facing in the illustration here. It isn't just a pragmatic decision. How many are we saving more lives in one circumstance than the other? And our goal is to save as many lives as possible.
Right.
That isn't the circumstance. And it's very easy for them to see that. If the person who is giving the illustration, for example, if this is the way they're going to argue, then they would have to say it would be justifiable for you to take their life to get their heart, their liver, their kidney.
Right. And that's exactly what he said back to me is, then, if that's the case, harvesting people or stem cells should be okay because you forcibly kill one innocent person to save
life. Right. Now, I understand the parallel there, but what I'm trying to do is make it personal to him.
Right.
Because then it would also be justifiable to kill that person right then to get that one person's kidneys, two of them, and liver and heart. So there's four lives for the sacrifice of one. Okay? If that's all we're doing.
Right.
With this equation is just as many lives as possible. The difference is this. When we take a human life, like embryonic stem cell research or even this young man's here or woman's, whatever, to take their parts to help somebody else, we are intending to take their life for the sake of saving the lives of others.
Right.
Okay? They're innocent, and our intention is to kill them to produce this effect.
Right.
When we go to war, our intention is not to kill innocent people. In fact, that's prohibited by most standards of war. And in fact, if we do that, if we intentionally kill innocent people, that is, we kill them for the sake of their innocence,
right,
then we've done something wrong.
Or what if?
Let me just finish the thought. Let me just finish the thought.
Okay,
because the principle here is important, because it is a principle in ethics called the principle of double effect, and that is our intention in going to war is to kill the bad guys to protect the good guys, to protect us. To kill them. And we foresee that in killing all of these bad guys that there's going to be some collateral damage, which we do not intend, but we do foresee. That's the difference. It is legitimate to take the collateral damage if you do not intend it, and you do not, even though you see it happening, it's not what you're intending to do.
But how can you not intend to take innocent life when you drop a nuclear bomb on a city?
Well, it may be that when you...
You can say you don't intend to take much human life.
Okay, well, now you're talking about a specific thing like Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Let's just set that aside because that may be atypical, okay?
Well, I would
say but if the issue of...
a bomb on any structure, you know that you're going to take out some...
I know, but your intention... Are you dropping the bomb to kill the innocent people in that building?
No.
Okay, so your intention is not to kill them. When you take the organs from a living person to kill them, so that are you intending to kill that person?
Yes.
Yes, of course. So the intention is an important part of a moral act, right? Okay, Doug, so when the question is, what is your intention when you drop the bombs? The intention is to take out a military a structure, it's to take out members of the army, but we know that by accident, unintentionally, there may be collateral damage, or we could even guarantee there's going to be collateral damage. The difference is that we're not intending that.
Do you believe God takes people's intentions?
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate moral distinction, and if it's a little legitimate moral distinction, it is one that God makes too, I guess. We're out of time, Doug. It's good to hear from you again. Call more often, and that was a good question. That's the end of the show, and I will be back in a couple of weeks for more of the same. And in the meantime, be intentional, friends, about being a good ambassador for Christ with an accurately informed mind, an artful method, and an attractive manner. Knowledge, wisdom, character. I'm Greg Kokel. For Stand to Reason, go out and give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye now.